Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
What I want to talk with you about tonight is based on a big project I run at Stanford. It's an $11 million multi-year project called The Boundaries of Humanity, Humans, Animals, and Machines in the Age of Biotechnology. And the reason this project came into being is I served on the President's Council on Bioethics during the Bush administration. I realized that we as a society were not contending with these difficult issues at the depth they needed to be. And so we set up this multidisciplinary group at Stanford with people from all over the universities, including five heads of departments, five former or present deans, and we're dialoguing on these very, very deep challenges to our human future. So the boundaries of humanity. So I thought it'd be interesting to start with this. I gave a talk at a conference at Harvard a few years back, and this was the poster for it. I thought it was quite interesting. Editorial aspirations. Human hands, what Aristotle called the tool of tools, the symbol of our distinctive body form and unique capacities of mind, our comprehension, our creativity, and our control over the world in which we dwell. Those hands are turning now to operate on our very selves. According to the National Intelligence Council report, Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds, we're at a critical juncture in human history, which could lead to widely contrasting futures, depending on how we deal with it. Nowhere is this more evident than the promise and peril of advancing biotechnology and associated applications of information technologies. Together with insights from ethology, that's the study of animal behavior, new perspectives and powers associated with advances in genetics, neurobiology, cognitive psychology, artificial intelligence and machine and robotics are blurring the boundaries between humans, animals, and machines and raising important and difficult conceptual and practical problems of profound significance to the human future. What is the meaning of mind, emotion, and moral awareness in animals? Are humans, as some maintain, just another ordinary animal species? What are we to make of predictions of conscious machines, neuromorphic computers and robotic servants, caregivers, and even companions? Can human nature be reduced to information processing? Are we, as MIT Professor Marvin Minsky said, just a meat machine? Will biotech-mediated enhancements of physical and mental powers open new horizons, or will they disrupt fundamental aspects of our humanity? Should we alter human physiology to increase our sensory range, dramatically extend the human lifespan, or genetically alter our offspring to enable interplanetary travel? That's been proposed, that we genetically modify ourselves to move out into interstellar space. Amazing. What issues of human dignity arise with the laboratory creation of synthetic embryos and human-animal chimeras? Don't worry, that's just a drawing so far. What similar issues arise with human-machine cyborgs, brain-computer interfaces, or modular neural implants? You've heard of Neuralink, I'm sure. What are we to make of proposals for the de-extinction of early hominid forms, our cousins, Neanderthals or Denisovans, or of the transhumanist projects for evolution by design of the human future? The transhumanists argue that Our advancing genetics and neurotechnologies offer us the opportunity to escape the constraints and cruelties of an amoral evolutionary process to lift humanity to the next level of personal and social flourishing as human-machine hybrid post-humans. And there's lots to be said about using technology to alter human life. But are we really, is it time for us to challenge the idea that genomes are somehow special and inviolable? Can we do better than mindless evolution? Is that where we came from, mindless evolution? I don't agree, actually. So the transhumanists, their symbol is H+, and all students know what that means. Humanity with a little A+ on it. So driven by urgent human problems in agriculture, environmental science, and biomedicine, global expenditures on biotechnology-related research and development is expected to reach nearly $500 billion within the next 5 years. So this is, it's not just theoretical stuff. This is major league transformation at the level of our most advancing science. And this is a quote from Yuval Noah Harari. How many of you have read any of his books, Homo Deus or Sapiens? You guys have, no one's read those? I'm glad to hear it. I think they're deceitful. I'd like to debate that guy because I think he's hyping it. Now he says, sapiens will upgrade itself into another kind of being within a couple of centuries at most. Earth will be populated by beings who are different from us in their cognitive and physical abilities. Well, maybe a little. How different is the question? And I don't think he's got it, because a subcurrent for what I'm going to say to you today is we haven't actually gotten to the point of deeply appreciating the mystery and majesty of the human form and its capacity to relate to the world in which we are all born. So that's our subtext, and we can talk about it after I finish in more specifics. But we're clearly, in any case, entering a multi-generational era of unprecedented advances in our ability to intervene at every level of human biology. And the heart of these dilemmas are fundamental philosophical and theological questions regarding the source and significance of human life and our place and purpose as co-creators within the cosmic order. These are questions that are fundamental to what it means to be human and how these technologies relate to our ultimate destiny individually and collectively and as a species made in the image of God. Notwithstanding all the headlines on politics and economics, these are the overarching but largely unrecognized challenges of our era. So you can see these are fundamental questions that we all ought to ask ourselves anyway, but technology's forcing them to the fore. Yet as we explore our varied approaches to answering these questions, it's immediately apparent there are two radically distinct and essentially incompatible terms of description that frame our self-understanding. One, from the detached and objective view of the empirical sciences, and the other from our subjective inward experience as sensitive, passionate, and purposeful living beings. So the descriptive terms of the physical sciences, matter and energy expressed, I'm a little ahead of myself here, matter and energy expressed in the language of mathematics, you all know this, very familiar. They're in sharp contrast with more human-level approaches of phenomenology, aesthetic thought, and personalism, where concepts such as mind, beauty, and spirit are often used to refer not just to humans, but to the perceived core realities of the cosmos. So easy to think everything reduces down to mathematics, molecules and stuff, without realizing that maybe more fundamental even is something like mind or spirit. The physicist Russell Standard noted, we draw more on this personalistic view when describing the very source and sustaining power of reality. When we really get down to it, our language about God as creator and ground of being is drawn from inward experience and expressed in personal terms, such as love, purpose, compassion, goodness, and morality, expressions that do not figure in physical equations, nor in computer code or models. He goes on to say that language used in reference to God is fundamentally that of consciousness, the aspect of human life that is at once most subjectively evident, yet most inexplicable within the current conceptual and methodological tools of the empirical sciences. What we know most clearly about ourselves is the most inexplicable in the scientific terms. Which tradition, which intuitions should we trust? Our current science or our long-standing religious ideas? So, very difficult challenge. A good first step would be to openly acknowledge that much that is real remains beyond the reach of our current scientific tools and methodologies, like I just said, consciousness, for one. We need to acknowledge that despite the remarkable advances in the empirical sciences, that whole approach, much about the science of the human person remains deeply mysterious. So on a practical level, what is needed is a comprehensive wisdom-seeking inquiry initiated with the goal of gaining a deeper understanding of human nature and human purpose amid the challenges and opportunities of advancing technologies. Through thoughtful consideration of how we differ from other animals, other species of animals, and current and foreseeable intelligent machines, we may seek a richer perspective on the biological, social, and spiritual implications of our particular embodied form and inward experience as human beings. So, humans, animals, and machines. To begin our consideration by comparing humans and machines seems at first to be harder, but at least at this point in our technological progress, it's actually far easier. No one denies that humans are animals, or that animals resemble humans in important respects. The question has always been, what kind of animal, and how different from others are we? But what does it mean if we are machines, or perhaps more disturbingly, if some machines are like us? What does it mean to say our minds are a technology, like other technologies, in being a set of mechanisms? I'm a little behind myself here. A set of mechanisms for the routine solution of set of problems. Okay? Is that what we are? Are we a machine for solving problems? There's something not quite right about this, something that's been smuggled in without our barely even noticing it. The human mind is an embodied mind, mysteriously issuing forth from within a living organism. We are inseparably body and mind. We are a psychophysical unity. That is the way we experience ourselves. Sometimes we feel like we're free-floating thought, but then we're acutely pulled back and aware of our physical frame. And though, since it's a mystery, that intuition could be wrong, it does seem like the mind is materially mediated and therefore arises within the minuscule molecular motions that we casually call mechanism, and therefore is a kind of technology of sorts. I mean, most of us don't think we just float around and by coincidence land in our bodies. We feel like our bodies are part of how we generate our being, and including our mental apparatus. But even if the mind is materially mediated, it is more than a technology or a mechanism, since it apprehends and draws into awareness concepts and ideas, immaterial realities that are as real or more real than matter in any way. Who knows what matter is in any case? That's a very great mystery. So that is, mind is internally operated, not just externally ordered like a human-centered and created machine. There's a self there with qualities of consciousness, including sentience, subjectivity, feelings, and a sense of freedom that are very unlike any mechanism. We don't think of machines as having freedom, do we? Computational machines, computers, and human reasoning may seem similar in their logical operations and cause and effect relations, but in the human, there's a mind. In that mind, other kinds of thinking, surrounding, suffusing, and strategically deploying the raw computational powers of mind. Nobody thinks the mind doesn't operate with some degree of computer-like actions. But the point is, there's more. There are hopes and fears, sifting, sorting, searching for solutions with meaning and personal significance, what's been called the enchanted loom. Early in the computer revolution, Stanford psychologist David Rummelhart famously said, the knowledge is in the connections. And those of you who are in computer science, you know that that was a very prescient comment. It was brilliant at the time regarding machine operations, and it's been the key to the development of neural networks and machine learning. But taken literally, it cannot be true. There is no knower there. There is no knower in a computational device. The computer knows nothing of the content or meaning. It has no sense of experience, no center of awareness. Even the terms it is trained on are reduced to digital tokens to be sifted, sorted, and shuttled in search of mathematical ratios and statistically predictive patterns. It is neutral with regard to purpose, values, and genuine knowledge. Mechanism, pure structure, is not the same thing as genuine knowledge. This was grasped properly and profoundly by Leibniz, who warned us. Moreover, it must be confessed that perception and that which depends upon it are inexplicable on mechanical grounds, that is to say, by means of figures and motions. And supposing there were a machine so constructed as to think, feel, and have perception, it might be conceived as increased in size while keeping the same proportions so that one might go into it as into a mill. That being so, we should, on examining its interior, find only parts which work upon one another and never anything by which to explain perception. The astrophysicist Arthur Eddington put it more plainly. Our knowledge of physics, that's what he's thinking of, our knowledge of physics is only an empty shell, a form of symbols, as is all of mathematics, by the way. It is knowledge of structural form and not knowledge of content. All through the physical world runs that unknown content, which must surely be the stuff of our consciousness. So, something is physically mediated, but it's more. What is that unknown content that Eddington speaks of? And how does human consciousness grasp hold of it? 25 years ago, Terry Winograd, another Stanford professor, and part of my project, by the way, he was a computer scientist. One of his best students was Larry Page, who started Google. So 25 years ago, Terry Winograd argued that the human mind is infinitely more complicated than mathematical logic would allow, that the patchwork rationalism, reasoning with simple facts and rules, that had guided AI for the previous 30 years was a misuse of analogy and a wrong-minded approach. He stated plainly, seekers after the glitter of intelligence are misguided in trying to cast it in the base metal of computing. Winograd cautioned that computers may be better understood as language machines. That's very prescient now in terms of large language models. They're better understood as language machines, machines that manipulate symbols, machine code, rather than thinking machines. So they're language machines, not thinking machines. But he noted that human language unlike machine code, ultimately depends on tacit understandings, not susceptible to mechanically determinable mathematical logic. So this is maybe the key to what I'm trying to say here. Tacit knowledge. Tacit means implicit, implied but not stated, with a content that's understood but not expressed and maybe not even expressible. Tacit knowledge is the broad awareness of reality, something grasped through active experience of living inseparably, thought and feeling, known within the fullness of embodied being. You as an individual process through the world, and you're taking in literally millions of sensory perceptions in a second. And you're forming feelings as well as structural knowledge of the world as you go. Tacit knowledge carried unconsciously as the background context for every thought and embedded in every expression of human language, as well as that which we don't put into language, but it is irreducible to mathematical logic, and partly it's because you are a person. As a person, you experience things in a way that only your particular kind of a form could experience them. For the human mind, that term tacit was described by Michael Pognani as personal knowledge. He went on to say, personal knowledge is basically we can know more than we can tell. And he said that not only is there knowledge that cannot be adequately articulated in verbal means, but also that all knowledge is rooted in that kind of personalistic tacit knowledge. It's based on a whole dynamic of your feeling as well as your existential awareness in traversing the world amid your goals and your fears and your whole relation with the world. If one steps back to consider more deeply what is actually going on in the embodied human mind, it's clear that it is dramatically unlike machine processing. The flesh and blood human being is organismally, it's an organismal self, and it has distinct awareness of existential realities, of personal place and purpose within the world. And like every organism, it dwells as precarious being. All organisms seem to know, whether they know what it is or not, they know that they're going to be in danger and die. Precarious being, organisms, potent but perishable, and as with all sentient beings, passionate and purposeful, churning and bubbling within the multiple streams of pleasures and pains, memories and aspirations, hopes and fears. Isn't that where you see your own life? Full of those strange and mysterious dynamics of feelings, images, aspirations. This human interpreter frame of tacit knowledge is of the personal autobiographical self, the narrative self, our sense of who we are, the nature of the world, and our place within it. A vast and varied store of memories and personal intentions sets the content of every thought. You know that, especially those of you who are pre-meds, because everything you do centers around that mysteriously imaged aspiration of getting into med school, right? It's like, and for those of you with other goals, that's just from my realm, you know that you're carrying this story about yourself that you're trying to fulfill. And these, in turn, are embedded within the interpretive context of our culture, within a mythic cosmology of origins and ultimate ends, all of which is tacit, tacit understanding, personal knowledge, flowing forth from the inward experience of our journey within the world. Today, the impoverished patchwork rationalism that Terry Winograd spoke of in earlier AI has been superseded by the deeper and more opaque processes of so-called machine learning, including large language models such as ChatGPT, algorithms and statistical models that computer systems use to effectively perform a specific task without explicit instructions. But again, the machine is not like the human mind. It appears to employ an entirely different mode of operation. Intense pattern recognition. That's what ChatGPT does. It's a kind of brute force processing in search of functional solutions. It's lacking the subtlety and comprehensive personal content and character of human cognition. Basically, ChatGPT is a master of predictions, mathematical correlations, not perception and meaningful thought. It is a mimic machine, not a truth seeker. You guys all know that? You know, basically what it's just figured out what letter comes next, what word comes after what word, what sentences work well together. I mean, I've got to admit, there's something mysterious going on there. It seemed to indicate to us that that embedded in the structure of our language, syntax, there's a lot more semantics, meaning, than we realize. In other words, our language is a lot more complicated than we actually appreciated, even probably most of us, even 5 years ago. But now we're beginning to see that even statistically, some things work and carry different meanings than slightly different. I mean, just think of, for example, if somebody said, the old red barn, you wouldn't feel the same about it if you heard the red old barn. You see, even that simple phrase has a logic to it that doesn't feel right in one form and does in the other. And that carries meanings. But if somebody emphasizes something that's different from what you expect, you know there's a different meaning coming through. So these are mimic machines. They're not truth seekers. And this brings us directly to the mystery of how do we know anything? How language arises? And how does it serve as the medium of human communication and the bearer of human culture? To understand this, we need to recognize how these capacities are grounded in the structure and dynamics of our embodied existence. Life lived in the world that itself speaks to us, that is, the world speaks to us through our experience, both physical and interpersonal, in an intelligible language of being. The world provides an intelligible language for us to discern. The given world, not just a neutral backdrop, not just a stage setting for our lives, but the very ground of the tacit knowledge that infuses all thought, language, and action, all meaning, the human factor. So machine learning is, at least for now, still a metaphor. And like all metaphors, it carries a certain limited analogy or similarity, but it is not the thing to which it is compared. So computers don't think, and brains do not compute, or at least they don't only compute. So machine learning is very deceptive. It seems persuasive. It's powerful, but it isn't what we think it is, or what many of us think it is. The Turing test, you know, that's where you got to decide whether it's a computer talking to you or a human, real human being behind the curtain. So far, the Turing test is not an indication of a human consciousness in a computer, but the measure of the gullibility of the human observer. Okay, there was some guy, you probably read about it, who got fired by Google because he just insisted that the large language model was actually consciously thinking as it talked to him. I don't think he was right. I don't know everything. I might be completely wrong what I'm telling you, but I don't think so. I think there's no, and most of the people who are thoughtful and know more than I do on these realms don't think so either at this point. And some people think eventually we'll get to machines that are going to have consciousness. I don't believe that. I think we aren't appreciating how complex and profound the human form actually is. And by the way, as we approach this next part of it, which is more on the biological side of it, I thought it'd be good for me to mention that you think, well, okay, it's all mathematics. To some extent it is. I mean, it's physical principles operating within a sphere of control and so forth. But it's so much more complicated than a computer could ever analyze. So even if it were all mathematics, the mathematics of the organic is just nothing like the mathematics of our current computer realms. And I don't think it'll be even with quantum computing or whatever next thing they come up with that you know, does exponential Moore's law advances. Here's just to put this in the frame of perspective. The human body has somewhere between 50 and 100 trillion cells. Okay, and it's been estimated that on average, a given cell, a single one of those cells, those trillions of cells, undergoes somewhere between 10 and 30 billion chemical reactions per second. Try modeling that on a computer. So, to understand how we know anything, we have to understand how this works organically. So machine learning is just a metaphor. At this point, our machines don't have real consciousness evidence that we know of. And those who dispense wild speculations about completely uploading the human mind in silico would do well to reflect on the indispensable role of the body, the organic substrate that supports the functioning of the human consciousness with all the complexity of personal context and contents that that implies. So these reflections on tacit knowledge and embodied knowing lead us out of Silicon Valley to the marshlands and mountains on either side, directly back to living nature and the mystery of animal minds. And most problematically, the question of what is it that distinguishes the human species from all other living beings? Throughout history, there have been repeated attempts to identify a single distinguishing characteristic that defines human nature and endows a privileged status within the natural and moral orders. And here's a partial list. I mean, you all know that crows are very clever, and obviously chimps and gorillas and so forth are remarkably like humans in many ways. But what distinguishes us? Well, here are some suggestions. The laughing animal, the animal that cooks, the featherless biped, the only creature with a marked projection in the center of its face, that's a nose, the only creature with genuine symbolic language, that's pretty good. The rational animal, Boethius thought that was 5th century, I think, 5th century BC, AD. Boethius said, individual substance of a rational nature. Yes, that's part of it. Also, a creature capable of creating and transmitting culture, metacognition, self-awareness, moral conscience, theory of mind, and the animal that blushes. There's all these various different ways of thinking about it. Yes, rationality is probably very, very good distillation of a lot of it. But how does rationality arise? As Boethius, don't show you that. Yet it's notable that throughout this long tradition, there was a reference in almost all those categories. There was a reference to both body and mind. We sense that the human difference and the difference it makes are most deeply distilled in the meaning of minds, yet the body is there as well. And of course, the animal that blushes is a direct reference to the human body, but also implicitly a reference to mind. But mind in its inwardness, I mean, why do people blush? Because something internal is being revealed, they're afraid, or they feel something. It reveals their mind, their inwardness, their self-consciousness, their sensitivity and social awareness, their morality and their spirituality, alert to the boundaries of self-disclosure, shame, and our personal place within the larger arena of the human story. That's all contained in that simple one category of blushing. Mark Twain's quip that man is the only animal that blushes or needs to, that's pretty revealing, relevant of our uniquely spiritual place within the natural order. But how do these distinctive capacities arise? What are their material, psychological, and social foundations? It's interestingly clear that they have deep roots in the origins of life. In other words, whatever we are, we're grounded in foundations in earlier life forms. But again, as with computers, it's not easy to make sense of what these differences are. It's easy to overinterpret similarities as identity. And again, the misplaced metaphors, just like with machines, we can get misplaced metaphors with regard to our relationship with animals, and they can confuse us by causing us to consider animals as humans. We all love those little stories, Beatrix Potter's little cute animals, and think of them as little human beings. Good little Peter Rabbit. We start to then get confused how we're dealing with animals, animal rights, viewing all human, on the one hand, endowing animals with more than they probably should have in terms of awareness of the world and the qualities we consider personhood. And on the other hand, degrading us, or evaluating human in terms of the animal foundations, and therefore viewing all human motivations and intentions as serving basic biological needs. Man as beast is the danger there. Though we share many capacities with animals, including certain aspects of intelligence, it's important to recognize that a quantitative difference can be the difference of a qualitative difference. A difference of degree can be a difference of kind. So if animals have a certain capacity to juggle a certain number of variables, for example, and we have 50 times as many, you can get a completely different kind of analysis and engagement with the world from that added quantitative difference. Becomes a qualitative difference. And the human brain is 3.5 times bigger than expected, even for an ape of our size. And many animals, insects, operate pretty effectively in the world in which they dwell with minuscule brains. So you can imagine what goes on inside the roughly 100 trillion neurons of the 100 billion neurons of the human mind with its, by some estimates, quadrillion connections. So obviously, also reorganization of anatomical, physiological, or neurologic patterns and novel combinations of functions can lead to radically new emergent properties. Although we share many of the basic parts of our brains with other mammals, their proportions, and the functional dominance of their interconnections differ in important ways. This hierarchy of neural refinements converges in the prefrontal cortex, the center of our abstract analysis, planning, decision-making, and rational comprehension and control. And it's a brain region in humans it's five times larger in humans than in chimps. So, by the way, Coco the gorilla lived up behind Stanford, and I got invited up by Penny Patterson, who ran the place, still does, to meet Coco. And it was disarming. Coco was very human in some ways. She kept pointing at my mouth and wanted me to open my mouth because I have some gold fillings, and she was fascinated by my gold fillings. But in terms of whether she was thinking and the categories of a human being, I didn't sense it. Penny Patterson thinks a lot more about it than I do, but I wasn't convinced. But it's also true that even small mutations in gene regulation, not even different genes, can have a dramatic impact on a species in both their form and function. This is evident in the anatomical and neurological changes in our vocal apparatus that allow spoken language. Most animal vocalizations, it turns out, are ordered under emotional rather than cognitive control. They're automated information exchanges, fixed action patterns limited in terms of flexibility and meaning. Typically, the animal, so-called animal language, has to do with reproduction, food, or alarm signals. Even great apes do not seem to have the voluntary fine motor control of the facial muscles of voice that we use in speech. Our speech is basically phonated gesture in the sense that we feel something, our configuration of our muscles produces a vocal production as the air passes through it. But animals, their vocal apparatus does not enable them to articulate the required vowels essential for speech. Even our close primate relatives cannot produce the vowels necessary for speech. Moreover, even where apes like Coco have been taught to use symbols to communicate, their range and depth of expression is very limited. As one researcher commented, you can teach them to speak, but they have nothing to say. Pretty amazing. Human speech, on the other hand, is primarily driven by cortical areas in the left hemisphere that allow for voluntary control and extreme flexibility. With this unlimited range of sequential sounds, human language allows the communication of a vast range of ideas, setting the central foundation for cooperative sociality, teaching, and the transmission and accumulation of culture. So that's a pretty big difference. That's the prefrontal cortex, that's the vocal apparatus, the brain that operates behind it. This distinctive example of anatomical neurologic revision allows a greater range of response, and it may be the key to the broader foundation of human freedom and the foundation of human uniqueness. I want to show you this video. How much time do we have left? So this is a goose, and you know, you think, oh, this smart goose, she knows to pull the eggs back into her nest. Well, it turns out she's not so smart. She's got this fixed action pattern. So anything with a curvature, she sort of knows it needs to go back into her nest. And so she pulls this billiard ball in along with her eggs. See, that's what they call a fixed action pattern. And most animal behavior seems to be built on a few central fixed action patterns. And yet... They're very limited. They're very deterministic. And even if they're fine-tuned to a particular niche, they limit the animal to that niche. Human beings are mysteriously... Oh, there's his light bulb. I forgot that was in that school. Not very enlightened, though. So human beings are different. We are more general-purpose organisms. Liberated from fixed action patterns, we're open to a wider range of responses. Together with the unique flexibility and adaptability of our anatomical form and our high level of neuroplasticity, this sets the foundation for greater top-down neurologic control. And top-down ultimately means ideas and conceptions and images, idealized images of the world. Ideas, concepts, and moral and spiritual principles become the central axis of human motivation and action, giving ascendancy to intelligence, imagination, and free will. Indeed, the open and indeterminate character of human nature is close to the core of our species-defining distinction. Rather than any one anatomical, physiological, social dimension, it's this broad concept, the capacity to apprehend ideas, ideals, and live in them and enact them. So we are a general purpose organism adapted for adaptability in every dimension of our nature, both somatic body and psychic mind. With our capacity for comprehension and control, we have no set way of being in the world. We are metaphorically speaking, a furless creature clothed by culture. So the French existentialist Simone de Beauvoir said, speaking of open nature, she said, human beings are that species which by nature has no nature. But that is, of course, not true. Our adaptability is grounded in the highly refined biology of our particular bodily form, and the meaning of our lives depend on it. And this brings us back to the mystery of the embodied mind, how it emerges from the most minute molecules, proteins, polymers, cells, and circuits, yet stretches forth in contemplation of the furthest reaches of the cosmic order, the human brain. I'm not maintaining that the brain does it all. It's the brain in the body, the neurologic system in the body. But the human brain, 3.5 pounds of the most complex physical structure in the known universe, nearly 100 billion neurons, and a network of such millisecond speed that they integrate maybe a quadrillion synaptic connections in a fantastic behind-the-scenes choreography that makes possible the thought and movement of real-time life lived at the human level of human perception. But how do we go from these basic neurons? What happened? How do we go from chemicals to consciousness, from primary physical forces to the vibrant sensitivity and self-awareness of the human person? While this is an enormously complex process, I want to point to just a few of the important milestones along the way. In doing so, we can at least recognize why our current computational devices come nowhere close to the capacities of organic nature, and then doing that, we can gain a deeper appreciation for the mystery and majesty of the human form. This, in turn, should give us pause when we endorse technological projects for the radical revision of the human body and mind. Yuval Noah Harari may be appreciated as a writer, but if he were in charge of the world and brought his agenda to being, I think he'd be hated by subsequent generations. What are the unique powers of this organic substrate of life? We don't have much time left, right? How much time do we have? For me to talk or for, okay, well, I'll give you a few of these. So just because it's sort of helpful to us, let's ponder for a moment what you can do without a mind. What do these are bacteria. So what kind of things can basic substances do that don't have minds? So this is a neutrophil, a white blood cell chasing bacteria, and this is what goes on in your bloodstream all the time. So it's all this is done is based on chemotaxis, the attraction of molecules to one another. And it's chasing down the chemistry of the bacterium. But look at it. Doesn't it look intentional? And finally, it grabs hold of it. Whenever I show this, people kind of cheer. Oh, it got it. You're sort of rooting for the neutrophil, right? And yet, that has no mind. It's just basic mechanism. It's organic mechanism. Isn't that amazing to realize what basic vital powers can accomplish in the absence of mind? How complex, capable, and apparently purposeful this purely mechanical biological system can be. So a mindless mechanism, yes. It vividly demonstrates the remarkable properties and potentials of organic molecules. There's no computer or robot even remotely like it at this point. Maybe we'll get partly there, but it's pretty remarkable what organic chemistry can do. So what are the milestones along the way to becoming the unique creature we are? And I'm just going to blast through these very quickly because each one would be a whole lecture in itself. The emergence of emotion, memory, and a sense of self. So there's an upward progression of these in evolutionary history. But when you reach human beings, we have this capacity to not just feel them within ourselves, because emotions are very fundamental to our thinking process. They guide and give value to certain thoughts versus over and against others. In fact, Leon Kass, quoting the philosopher Hans Jonas, who was a study of Heidegger, by the way, we were talking about Heidegger at dinner. Hans Jonas was a student of Heidegger. Leon Kass quotes Jonas saying, "Desire, not DNA, is the deepest principle of life." And when you realize the role of desire even in very fundamental organisms, but all the more in human beings who have not just desire for what may be in lower animals certain sort of physical pleasure. We have intellectual pleasures. We have spiritual pleasures. And we actually desire, in the Catholic tradition, the beatific vision is the highest order of human desire, the kind of unity with God. We long in our hearts for this. And that has very deep motivation. People will literally die for that. I hope all of you would die for your Lord. But how amazing that that kind of a desire for something of eternal transcendent purpose can actually take place within the body of an organic being on the earth. So we have these inbuilt mechanisms of feedback in our bodies, interoception is what it's called, feelings that tell us to both where our bodies are and what good or not good is happening to them. And then within our facial construction, we have over 30 facial muscles that have very subtle changes. Now I can look around my classroom, my seminar class, and I can tell who's interested or who wants to say something just by the little subtleties of their facial expression. And when we look at one another face to face with this furless canvas of communication that the human body has, uniquely, we stand upright posture, we look into each other's faces, and we literally feel in small pattern what the other person is feeling. And we often, by the way, repeat what they're feeling and saying to us. We resonate, if you will. So there's very fundamental organic processes going on, all mediated by neural connections. So desire, not DNA, is the deepest principle of life. By the way, if you've never read Leon Cass's works, I'd highly recommend them. He was the chair of the President's Council I served on, and is a very, very smart and noble person. Okay, and then beyond that, what about the emergence of what is the human form? I just said we're face to face, amazing creatures. We have a range of operation of our arms, for example, and other parts of our body, but just think what your hands can do. I referenced at the very beginning. We can dance. We can build things. We can do all manner of things with our hands and our freed arms. Really amazing construction. And what you can do within the world correlates very specifically with what your mind thinks about. The mind and the body go together. So the human form is very central. There's a comprehensive creativity and constructive action in our bodies. So what else? As I said a minute ago, the face is the basis of communication, of language, sociality, and the collective mind, cooperation, and the accumulation of culture. Not just little bits of culture that some primates seem to have, but the accumulation, transmission of culture, very different. That's the facial muscles. The face is the indicator of the mind. How about that? We all know growing up how crucial faces are. And babies at the breast look at the mother's face while they're nursing in the oxytocin-nourished environment of that very deep, abiding love between mother and child. They are socialized. Way before they can speak, they know the meaning of some languages, and they are imitative. Fundamentally, we're an imitative. Aristotle knew that. And we just model ourselves by relating to one another in our body forms, and the body forms express the mental forms. And we transmit culture, complex cultures, and all this is driven by the power of imagination, which can create in the mind that which is not yet, but could be. And that is probably the most powerful of all the human endowments of difference, the principles, the aspirations, and the envisioned ideals. That's the meaning in the final end of spirituality. It's the combination of apprehension of that which we know of the physical world and that which we learn of the spiritual world. And we, uniquely then among creatures, can imagine what it is to be another suffering human being and can reach out in love. Love is perhaps the single defining capacity. The great biologist from Harvard, who was himself at least surface-wise atheistic, E.O. Wilson, spoke of genuine altruism as the culminating mystery of the natural world. So, love, we know somehow that this should not be. So there we are. We're very close to the dilemma of our future. We all know it. We all know that things are escalating in a geometric way. We all know that we're facing very profound challenges as a civilization. Some of the possibilities are truly horrifying. And I think when President Trump was talking about World War III, right or wrong, with regard to Zelensky, we all know that World War III is something we do not want to have happen. As Einstein said, World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. In other words, the collapse of everything we've ascended to as a collective global civilization. So, what is love? Love is deeply sacrificial. Love is mysteriously unearthly and unbiological, while very central to biological survival. And how are we going to go forward with our advancing technologies? What will we with those hands do that are getting to operate not just on the world, but on our very selves? How will we guide it? Well, I think a good principle would be the principle that C.S. Lewis once well articulated when he said, we should answer all of our problems, meet all of our challenges, with more love, not less love. We're both spectators and actors in the great drama of creation. We've come upwards from the mystery of tiniest molecules to open and expanse the understanding of the cosmos. Those hands need to be touched by the mystery of God's providence that lead us to comprehensive understandings of our place and purpose within the cosmos. If we were to keep from what the great theologian Louis Bouillet spoke of, that we must find a certain voluntary poverty if we are not to reduce the world to ashes.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.